Hello, Tomorrow Built Today listeners. This is one of your co-hosts, Nicole Quinn. For those of you new to the podcast, we cover investing trends and predictions, along with discussions around the latest news in consumer tech. In this episode, I had the pleasure of moderating a panel in the future of investing from an LP perspective. The panel was hosted by the amazing Female Founders Fund at an event in San Francisco on Monday, March 11th. You're going to hear from three experts in the LP world on their thoughts around what's to come in 2019, diversity in the LP world, and what makes a successful LP and GP. The panel included Lo Tony, a former partner at Google Ventures and now the managing partner of Plexo Capital, Lisa Edgar, managing director at Top Tier Capital Partners, and also David DiPietro, portfolio director at Greenspring Associates. So please join me in welcoming Lo, Tony, Lisa Edgar, and David DiPietro as we jump right into the discussion.
We are now going to kick off the last panel of this afternoon, and we're thrilled to welcome four panel members today, and I'm going to introduce all four of them. Nicole Quinn is a partner at Lightspeed and joined the team after graduating from GSB, has been an investor in some really fast-growing consumer brands that you may know, Goop, Daily Harvest, Rothy's, amongst others. We also have Lo Tony, who's the founding partner of Plexo Capital, who is also a limited partner in Female Founders Fund. Lo started Plexo a few years ago, and before Plexo was at GB, so he incubated Plexo from Google Ventures. We also have Lisa Edgar, who we're thrilled to have join us. She's a managing partner at Top Tier Capital Partners, and David DiPietro, a portfolio director at Greenspring Associates. So really excited to hear from all of you and chat about investing in the future from an LP perspective. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Nicole.
Hi, everyone. Hope you're all well. I am really excited to do this panel with Lo, Lisa, and David. They are the experts in the LP world, and I'm super excited to hear from them. Just their insights around the landscape and issues around diversity. Anu did such a fantastic job introducing everybody, so I think we should just go straight into Q&A, if that's okay. So my first question, we're starting with a big one. Predictions for 2019. So what are the trends that you're most excited about from an LP perspective in the landscape? Lo, you want to start us off?
Sure, I could start us off. You can keep your mic. We got another mic. Let's see. Ryan from NextPlay Capital and I were just talking a little bit about esports. So I'm a big fan of esports.
Me too.
And I have a very simple thesis. I just know that this year and next year, more people will be playing games than are currently playing. More people will be playing games together than are currently playing games together. And more people will be watching people play games. I don't necessarily know which games they'll be playing, but I'm highly confident in those three things.
So predictions, I'm going to turn that into wishes, if you allow me. 10 unicorn IPOs. This year. How do you like that?
I mean, I think that could happen.
Yeah. I'm going for it.
Lightspeed portfolio alone.
It could. It could. So that's a prediction. I really do think finally these companies are going to go public, and I don't want to think what that's going to do to housing prices in San Francisco, on the other hand, but I do think there's a lot of them teed up and that will happen. As far as areas of interest, we're really looking at kind of developer-led companies. There's a lot of movement and a lot of interesting stuff happening there. We still like everything that's going on with the cloud. There's still a lot that hasn't been moved. We like tech coming into new, kind of not new businesses, tech coming into old line business like logistics and ag and things like that. We think there's still a lot of opportunity there. Digital health, those are the areas. Some of the frontier technologies, you know, there's a lot of activity, but it's still hard to figure out how that's all going to play out. So I think some of these more enterprise businesses we're pretty excited about.
Yeah, I think from
something we're excited about is I just think it's going to be another great year for M&A. I think the IPOs tend to capture all the headlines, and I was a former capital markets person, so that's all I used to care about. But I just think the amount of dollars to buy these companies from $500 to $1 billion, which for most people will be very good returns, I think it's going to be a great year for that, just because there's just so much capital from so many different corners of the market that I think will pursue it. Also think we continue to see unbridled enthusiasm from LPs who haven't really played in venture. Since we're both an LP and a GP, I think, you know, we're just seeing so much more interest. And while that can be scary and toppy, I think there are just people who realize that they need to have that asset class as part of their portfolio. And we're just seeing a lot of people who've been sitting on the fence for years, looking at it, afraid of it, whatever, now trying to move into it. So those are both, I think, good things. We're not going to run out of capital, I don't think, anytime soon for what we're doing.
So we've looked into the future, and now we're going to reflect a little bit on the past. So question specifically for David and Lisa. You've been investing in micro funds before they were a thing. And so as you look back over the last 5 years, tell us a little bit about how you've seen that space evolve.
I think the most obvious is just the sheer number of funds that have been created over the past 5 years. You know, we all probably have a lot of inquiry and a lot of people introducing us, and it just seems more and more that if people want to get into the business and want to run a portfolio, some of which came from more the entrepreneur founder world and then started running some of their own money and now want to really make it more institutional and make it part of their career. So I think that's really one of the big things that have driven it. But what's happened over that same amount of time is people have become more specialized. So you have seed and you have pre-seed and you have pre-A and post-A, you know, just all these different cuts of it. And then, of course, there's sector focus funds as well, and geo focus funds and different things like that. And so the market just keeps getting a little bit more specialized. On the types of people running these funds, and we've done some of these workshops ourselves with like the RAISE conference and things like that, but they've become so much more professional. I mean, the decks, how people present to the institutional investors, what the stories they're telling, what they know to come in with, has just become much more professional. And in some ways, it's made our job a lot harder, because there was a lot of, early on, it was like, you really don't know what you're doing. And now it's like, holy smokes, you know, at least you know what to say, you know, and then we'll see if you know what to do. So that's really been, I think, a significant change over the last 5 years.
Yeah, so not to repeat anything, Lisa's much more the expert on micro than I am, but we started about 5 or 6 years ago, realizing this was a group of funds that we had to better understand, even though we really didn't have a particular mandate for micro. We used to stick a few of them in our fund of funds, but you know, 5 micro funds in a fund of funds really is hard to move the needle. So we finally got an anchor LP to help start our first micro fund, and now we sort of have 10 to 15 funds in each of the first two of those. And what's really challenging about it, besides just that there's so many of them, is the hours of analysis and vetting these funds per dollar that we invest is completely skewed. And so you just have to spend so much time covering the landscape. And we've also found sort of a lot of LPs who invest in our funds are actually just using us because we have a lot of people doing the work, because it's impossible to allocate the amount of time you need. I think I'd agree with the professionalism comment, and also we're big fans of emerging managers at sort of all stages, and some of the people that are doing seed funds now are just have great track records doing very early investing from a previous, now larger fund, and so there's some incredible and proven talent in the micro sector. And I think there's going to be some of them that are going to stay micro funds for many fund cycles. But the exciting thing for us, having some bigger funds to put in into Series A, is I think a number of these are going to graduate and be, you know, awesome Series A funds, and later as they, you know, kind of get a couple of fund cycles under them. So it's a very diverse group of funds, and I think a lot of upside in the sector if you can afford to spend the resource and time on it.
So Lo, we have a separate question for you. So Lo's path into VC was an interesting one. Into being an LP was an interesting one because he started as a VC. You and I actually met when you were back at GV. So tell us a little bit about why you decided to start Plexo. What was the motivation? And also separately, the focus that you have on women and minorities overall. So tell us a little bit about why you're focusing on the underrepresented groups.
Yep. Thanks. Happy to do it. I was formerly a partner at GV, or Google Ventures, as it was known before the Alphabet restructure. It's the early stage investing unit for Alphabet. And Larry and Sergey, the founders of Google, laid out a simple task. How do we deploy more capital through GV? And when we looked at different opportunities, the obvious were write larger checks. We didn't really want to do that because that was the domain of our cousin, Capital G, or formerly Google Capital. And didn't want to go outside of our lane into areas that we didn't really have a lot of depth and understanding. So the natural place to go was, how do we identify more deals that have the same criteria that we can then evaluate? And one thing we thought was interesting, just reflecting and looking at the landscape, was how many of the new funds, the seed stage funds, had a much more diverse representation in their partner base than if you looked at some of the larger, more established funds. And the more that we dug in, by the way, this wasn't a surprise to me, but the more that we dug in, we saw that women and people of color in particular have a non-traditional path to venture and end up with some interesting networks, as well as, and this is important, especially for early stage, a different lens to be able to evaluate opportunities. So oftentimes seeing things in the absence of an abundance of data and seeing a great opportunity before others might actually recognize it, because if they don't understand the market, they actually might need the data. So GV made 5 LP investments into seed stage funds led by a woman or a person of color. Ryan Neese of NextPlay was one of those original GV5. And I looked at it as, so it was a great way for us to get access to deal flow at an early stage that we weren't seeing. We ended up investing in a lot of those companies. I subsequently looked at it as a way to be able to create a new type of platform and have the focus be investing as an LP with the same thesis, but then to source direct deals from those portfolios. My former manager, David Crane, the CEO of GV, and the person that GV reports into at the Alphabet level, David Drummond, everyone thought it was a great concept, so I incubated it. And I also thought that if GV was interested in finding these deals, that some of the other venture units associated with corporates would be as well, especially because GV doesn't really position themselves as a corporate VC. So I was right, and we spun out almost a year ago today with a $50 million fund that invests 60% as an LP, same thesis, 40% direct. We have Alphabet as our anchor, Cisco Investments, the Royal Bank of Canada, Intel Capital, my undergraduate institution, Hampton University, which is a historically black college, and a Cambridge Associates client, so we went through that process. So that's really the thesis. You know, there's no mandate to invest into companies that are led by a woman or a person of color. However, of the 10 directs that we've done, only one is not led by a woman or a person of color. And I just think, the data shows that when you have a diverse set of investors around the table, surprise, surprise, you end up with a diverse portfolio. So that's a little bit about our story. I also will say that Female Founders Fund was the first commitment after the original GV5, and everyone that heard that I was going after this told me, oh, well, you got to talk to Female Founders Fund then. I mean, so I was getting all these different angles.
So this is now a question for everyone. We're going to start with David. Tell us a little bit about your direct investment strategy, how this has evolved over time, and then also a little bit about how that factors into your consideration of new fund investments as well.
Sure. So Greenspring started in 2000, and from the very first fund that we raised, which was $52 million, approximately 30% of the assets went into direct deals. And our direct strategy is a couple of criteria. One is that we only will invest in a direct where one of our existing manager relationships is in the syndicate and is participating in the round that we're doing at least their pro rata, hopefully even more than that. So we're not boiling the ocean for directs. We're only doing it within our manager universe. The second thing I think that we've learned over time is that we are much better evaluating companies at the stage where they're about to scale versus the stage where they're taking technology or product market fit risk. So predominantly, we're in the sort of Series C and beyond stage of investing, and been fortunate to do a number of great deals, direct deals with Lightspeed and others. And then I'd say the other sort of tenet of our direct strategy, and we're putting out almost as much money per year now into directs as we are into funds, which no one would have believed, you know, 5 years ago, is that we want to immediately sort of try to add value to the company from day one. We do it even before we put money in sometimes, but we have a whole team oriented around sort of, we call it portfolio impact, but value add services, whether it's recruiting events, you know, introducing them to strategic larger companies, to customers, whatever. And we really have sort of a SWAT team approach to that, because just showing up with a check these days is not really a unique capability. So so that's what we've been doing. I'd say it's evolved a little bit in that we can write bigger checks now, but we really, I'd say the other part of it is it gets us closer to our main GPs, because we're doing deals together with them, we're on cap tables with them, and so it has that sort of ancillary benefit of strengthening those relationships. I'd say when evaluating new managers, we clearly, it's on the list of things we want to consider is, will this be a firm where we might see direct deal flow? I'd say in the micro category, you know, we sort of soften that a little bit, because by definition, most of the companies where they'd have the ability to show us something are probably still a little bit early for us. So having said that, we've had a few in the last 2 years from micro funds that we've actually put some money into directly, but I'd say at the Series A and Series B managers, that's something we pay a lot of attention to, is the possibility of direct deal flow.
Yeah, so we have a pretty active, we'd call it more of a co-investment program than a direct investment, because we're doing deals with our trusted relationships. Also, probably Series C, kind of 10 million ARR area. Not a lot of healthcare, mostly on the tech side and tech-enabled businesses and services. We don't necessarily invest behind a manager because of the deal flow, but it does get us closer to working with folks and really cements that relationship. And, you know, it's been a really successful program for us, and I get it. You know, we're in a 10-year bull market. That is not lost on me by any stretch of the imagination. But I think, you know, once you get going with a strategy, a direct strategy, you kind of understand what you know and what you don't know, where you fit in. We don't have additional services and stuff. I think of us as more supportive capital. We can price around. We could lead around. We can put in 5 to 15. We want, you know, information rights. They've asked us to be on the board a couple times. We're mostly observer. I mean, I've been an observer on a actually fairly technical board, which is interesting, but it's something that I think most institutional investors are interested in today is the directs, and you know, all three of us have active programs, obviously.
It's the core of our strategy to be able to find managers that we believe are seeing exceptional deal flow where we can add a different vector of value. The other piece that's interesting for us is because we do have corporates that through their venture units have invested into us as an LP. One of the things that we do is the same thing we did at GV, which is if we see companies that we think are interesting, we'll proactively send those to our downstream investors, our LPs who are downstream investors, to see if there's any interest. And then they can also go in through a platform that we have to see if there's any deals that might be of interest to them. And, you know, they can slice and dice by industry stage and geo.
So it's
is that on the customer side too? Are you trying to connect them, the companies, to customers that are your LPs, or more just investors? Just
so curious. We haven't opened it up to the So your question is
the corporate LPs in your fund, are they maybe customers of some of these companies too?
So they're not, but the next evolution is to open it up to the portfolio companies, so that if they see the potential for either a downstream investment or a customer relationship, to be able to broker that as well. Yeah, to add value. And then we'll see deal flow that'll come from our investors that's too early for them, that we then try to send out to our GP network as well. Or it might come directly to us and we say, this isn't really our model. We like to work with our GP. So typically we're investing by a referral from one of our GPs. It could be, for the most part, because it's in their portfolio, or they just saw something that they thought that might be interesting for us. We'll perform our own diligence and figure out how we can add value and take it from there.
Thank you. So if you look back and think about the different fund managers that you've backed over the years, if you specifically think about the most successful ones, I'd love it if you could tell us a little bit about the commonalities, particularly in terms of background of those fund managers. Lisa, why don't we start with you?
Okay. Commonalities. So I've actually been doing this a long time, and so I think many years ago, there really were no commonalities. Somebody was a history professor. Somebody came out of Goldman. You know, it really was somebody who was a publisher and in the media, right? I think everybody knows who I'm talking about with some of these folks. And so it was slightly random. It was just if you had a good nose for understanding companies and could, you know, attract talent and such, that you actually could be a good VC. I think today there appears to be this kind of mind meld entrepreneur founder to entrepreneur founder, you know, at least certainly in the seed stage. So they can really relate to a VC investor who also has been in their shoes. You know, there's data sets that show, yep, they're more successful. There's data sets show that they're not. But I will tell you that certainly seems to be the trend today.
Yeah, I'll just say that for us, we focus on sub $100 million funds where the primary point of entry is either pre-seed or seed, and the GP is taking a lead typically, so writing a term sheet, issuing a term sheet. The model that I like the most is at this stage when it's so important to understand nascent markets. I've always been taught that the closest playbook to early stage investing is the playbook of the product manager. So I do have I favorite those GPs that have had some entrepreneurial or at least some product experience or have good product chops. I mean, that can manifest itself in many different ways. The ways that I've seen it most successfully is from an entrepreneur. I mean, you know, when you're a CEO at an early stage, you pretty much are the product manager, at least you should be. And or people that have come from, you know, some of the larger companies that have very well-run product management. I've also seen great folks from corporate development, especially if it's a person from corp dev that has where the corp dev shop was very strategic and worked closely with the business unit. So usually that corp dev person has to have an understanding of product so that they can act on behalf of the business unit when they're thinking about a company and whether or not it's going to be a good fit. They really have to understand kind of the objectives, and that usually boils down to an understanding of the company or the customer and the product. It just seems like at the later stage, that's when there's more numbers, that's when, you know, some of the people that maybe have more banking or consulting backgrounds can really kick in and shine. But I think there needs to be, at the early stage, there needs to be an understanding of product.
I guess just to try to cover things that addition to what's already been said, which I would totally agree with all of it. I think, you know, team chemistry amongst the team, how many funds they've sort of done together, or how much they've done together. I think a good mix, especially if it's more than one or two people, GPs of different backgrounds, particularly professional backgrounds, as well as other backgrounds. I think, you know, some investors, some history professors maybe, some definitely operators, I think is good. We also try to spend a lot of time looking at the fund model. is the fund set up to get decent ownership positions, so if they happen to be right about something that's a big winner, that they actually own enough of it for it to return the fund or be a meaningful contributor to the fund. Sometimes we see a good portfolio of names, but the ownership isn't there to generate an overall fund performance that's as attractive as it would otherwise be. And we tend to favor, frankly, smaller funds. I think the average fund that we invest in is probably under $300 million, even though we have some very big ones in there as well. So I think those are some of the other things that we look at.
So as three of the LPs that Female Founders Fund and Lightspeed consider to be really driving change in this industry, I'd love it if you could share with us a little bit about how you think about the work that you're doing in terms of how it can make change around the Me Too movement and some of those issues in the industry at the moment.
I'll start. So One of the things you think about when all this came, you know, really hit the press and really nobody can escape and pretend like you didn't know it anymore, it was this notion of kind of shining the spotlight on what was happening in the industry and in other industries as well. And, you know, there's a lot of organizations, there's a lot of discussions. And for me particularly, I think, you know, we've always talked about some of this, but maybe not as boldly and as openly as we do today. And I think it's given us all the comfort and the ability to ask the questions and to have the discussions and conversations that need to be had. They're uncomfortable. A lot of, you know, this is kind of new language for everyone and just really understanding. But as an LP, you know, there was this whole question early on, is it the LPs, because they're giving the VCs the money, and they're, you know, and who's, and it was like, no, it's everybody. Everybody needs to be in the discussion and taking a part of what is happening. And I have to say that I've seen real changes over the last couple years. And, you know, it's hard to be a woman in the industry when people are looking and said, oh, well, you know, what is happening and how could you work in that industry and such. And that's when you say, you know, this is what we're doing and these are the changes and this is the constructive things that are happening. But it really is the open dialogue, I think, is one of the most important things.
Yeah, I'll just add an anecdote that happened recently, which is, so my model is to look at funds led by a woman or a person of color, and early on I was asked about percentage ownership of the GP in terms of the different partners, and did I have a particular target if it was you know, maybe a woman or a person of color plus someone that was not. And I didn't, because at the time when you looked at most funds, if it's, you know, if it's a sub $100 million fund on average, we're probably looking at $40 to $50 million funds. And it's, you don't really have enough management fee to support more than, you know, a couple of GPs anyway. However, recently, I got into a unique situation without naming names, of course. I, you know, it was a situation where the person that started the fund had brought on a partner, and this person was a woman or person of color. And, you know, it made me think, I was like, you know, wow, this person is very important to the future of this fund. There's going to be a succession plan ultimately, and this person will take the mantle. And so it made me think to ask, I was like, God, you know, I got to ask what percentage ownership this person has, because, you know, in this environment of people trying to show that they have diversity, whether, I mean, in some cases, it quite frankly is just window dressing. I think in other cases, people do recognize the value of tapping in to other networks. But it's, I'm not going to say easy. It's if you have a track record, you will get a look from some of those larger funds that are looking to fill a role with a woman or a person of color. And so my immediate thought was, wow, what if someone came dangling like $1 million a year salary at this person and they snatched it up? Then all of a sudden, I've made this investment basically kind of thinking about this person ultimately moving forward. And I raised that, and I asked, you know, hey, what's the structure look like of the GP and for the fund? And they actually paused. They were like, wow, you know, none of our LPs have ever asked us that. But when we reflected, we thought,
this is the GP talking, would we as a GP ever invest in a company where we didn't know the cap table and the ownership to understand where the incentives were? So I think, I don't know, that's just something that, and I think back to your point about now we can ask these questions. And it's not like I'm saying it has to be a certain percentage, but I suspect just by LPs being in a position to ask these tough questions, I think we can actually affect some change that way as well.
Yeah, I think the good news is that I think we are all now much more sensitized to the issues, and you know, we're trying to be a driver of change. I mean, I think we all have a long way to go. The press is never going to probably give us anywhere near the credit that we may or may not deserve, so we're just going to have to, I think, move forward and chip away at the issue. I think we're involved with the diversity task force at the NVCA. Actually, Ashton, our co-managing partner, was a co-chair of that. We've worked on a couple of with Lo at the office hours. Now, I think I was at the one on the West Coast. There was one on the East Coast more recently. So there's things we can do kind of externally, industry-wide, and I think we also are trying to be cognizant of our own internal profile as a firm, and so we've actually adopted for those of you who are familiar with the Rooney Rule that the NFL put into place, where every open position, we will interview a diverse candidate, regardless of what the position is, at least one, and I think that has resonated with the diverse people already at the firm, that we are actually making a concerted effort for every job that comes along, as opposed to just hiring somebody that we see and like right away if they're not diverse. And so I think we're just, you know, trying to do things at every, you know, every turn that we can to deal with the situation. We are believers that, you know, diverse firms and companies are going to do a lot better than others. And but I don't think the press is going to be our friend anytime soon. So we just have to try to stay focused on what we're doing. And
So a couple of last shorter questions from me, and then we're going to go into audience Q&A. So very briefly, I'd love it, and anybody jump in on this one, if you could tell us about any differences you see between male and female fund managers. And anyone
shout. That was a hard question, I will tell you. Like, daggone. I will tell you, the only thing I will say is, the older I get, the more I absolutely respect all my women friends, because a lot of us go through the same thing. And the only thing I could tell you about that question is that's what guys always thought. That's what they always felt. You know, they always had that camaraderie that we're men, and now we're like, we're women. And we all look at each other and go, yeah, we know what that is. Even if you're married or not married or have kids or not kids, it there's just something like that. And that's the only answer I could give you, because that's a daggone hard question.
I was a little curious about it when I saw it as well. But so I spent almost 25 years in a house with four women who I love all dearly. And I
assume those are your kids or your sisters?
Three kids and a wife. And
I'm sorry.
I never hesitated to think. I never hesitated to think that they were going to be successful, have, you know, struggle to be heard or to be, you know, valued for their talents. And so, I would just say, in terms of managers, though, Nicole, is that we just, regardless of how you want to define it, we look for a complementary set of people at a firm. And that can take on a number of different manifestations. But I do agree with you. I think the camaraderie issue is something that there's no reason that it shouldn't exist in a more diverse atmosphere. There should be a ton of camaraderie around the mission of the firm and what they're doing, and I don't see any reason why we won't see that. But I don't know. I feel like I'm uniquely qualified to work well with women after the last 25 years, but I hope everybody can and does.
Thank you, David. That's not bad. Okay, so last question for you. Can you share with everybody in the room maybe a fund manager and one thing that they did that really impressed you? And we're going to leave it there before Q&A, and everyone start thinking of your questions.
I have one fund manager that does
just a world-class job at making LPs aware of opportunities to invest. Just always is at the forefront of, hey, this is the company. This is the reason why we invested in the first place. They're about to go out and raise the next round of financing. Here's some of the work that we've done as a teaser, and let us know if there's interest on your part of learning more about the opportunity. And just, it's just the same structure, so I know exactly where to go to get the information that I need. It's very short, it's concise, and it's very timely. It's always enough time for me to actually do something if I choose to do so, and I think they're world-class at it.
So I'm actually going to do a shout out to Anu and Sutian, and it was yes. You really were the first ones I thought of when I looked at this question. So, and you've asked me this question: how do you maintain that relationship? What's the right type of communication? The right amount of communication? The brevity of the communication, the follow up, and everything. And I think you two do just a fabulous job. We looked at deal. We looked at fund. We had a lot of interaction, and they were just all very positive, efficient, clear, on time. Just all of that stuff. So kudos to the two of you, really.
I'll answer the question, but I would also echo that. When I spent an hour or a half or whatever it was in an office with you that day, I walked out like they're finishing each other's sentences. They know exactly what each one of them is best at and what the other one's best at. It was very refreshing. So the other thing that really impressed me about a recent annual meeting that I went to, and I won't clearly won't disclose which firm, but they kept referring in competitive situations, how they got on the CEO or the founder's good side and how they ultimately ended up being able to invest. And they referred to it as, we won the right to partner with the entrepreneur. They didn't say we outcompeted the other venture firms that were trying to get into the deal or we got to invest. That's the language they always use. And they use, and several different GPs used it in the meeting. We won the right to partner with the entrepreneur. And I just thought, boy, that is a refreshing way to think about, that they're flattered and honored to be able to partner with that entrepreneur on their journey. And I think GPs who take that approach and then as soon as they write the check, do everything in their power to help the company succeed is always the most impressive thing I think we see. Some of them are so good at it.
Before I hand over to Anu, given the fact that Lightspeed are now LPs in a few different funds, I'm just going to quickly answer this question myself as well. The fund that I have definitely been most impressed with is you guys, to embarrass you further. You have become our eyes and ears in New York. We don't have a New York presence, and in my mind, there is not a female founder company that exists in New York without you not just knowing about it, but knowing them and having personal, strong relationships with them. And it is exceptional. So I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to invest in Female Founders Fund. So thank you. And I know there's lots more questions for these guys coming up. So I'm going to hand over to Anu to get the questions from the room. So more Q&A for you guys. Thank you.
Can I just give my quick shout out to F3 as well? I do want to get invited back to the event.
Is it F3 or F cubed?
Exactly.
What are
Female
we calling
Founders
it?
Fund.
Both want
Female Founders Fund.
So I will just say to echo, the thing that I think about most is obviously any deal that has a female founder involved goes through. I've even heard stories of male-founded teams that have come and said, hey, if we add a female founder, will you consider us? But also just the world-class events. Has anyone been to the female CEO event in New York City? Yeah, see, that's like if you go to that, that will make you think that they have a team of 50 people at the fund investing out of a $1 billion fund. And we used this term earlier. They are definitely, to use a sports metaphor, punching well above their weight class in terms of their presence. And I start to describe people as, oh, well, they're kind of like the Female Founders Fund for this region or for this industry because they see all the deals.
Thanks again for listening to this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, please do go to iTunes or wherever you're listening to it right now and do rate and review it. You can also find us on tbtpodcast.com. Tomorrow Built Today is produced by Lightspeed Venture Partners. The theme music you heard today is by Mikhail Minerville. And if you want to follow our guest today, we'll be putting their Twitter and websites in the show notes. You can find it all there. Thank you, everyone.